Minister. May we hand over to you for response?
Well, thank you very much, Chairperson, and honourable members for their, I think, probing and very interesting questions, which I think allows us to elaborate a little bit on the presentation itself. I'm going to connect the Honourable Mabasa's question on plans versus outcomes to a question that the Honourable Shlengwa asked on the courts, to a question that the Honourable Ntuli asked about vertical and horizontal integration, I'm going to indirectly connect it to the Honourable Mubu's question on interface or entities. And try as I, much as I try, I can't connect it to a question that the Chair asked in this first round, but at least we connect all of these into the first reply. The role of the department is coordination. But coordination doesn't mean simply getting everybody into a meeting and having a good chat, sip a cup of tea afterwards, and on a friendly basis leave. It's outcome directed. So let me illustrate it with a practical example. And I want to use the example of buses. When this administration came into office in 2009, at one of the early portfolio committee meetings, honourable members will recall, we spoke about the importance of infrastructure and localization. That work eventually led into the new growth path, and in the new growth path, infrastructure was identified as the first jobs driver, and localization was identified as one of the important policy drivers. So that's the work the department did initially in the first phase. Now from there, we supported the integrated public transport system. In Joburg it's called Rea Vaya, in Cape Town it's called My City. It's programs to connect bus, taxi, rail in a more seamless way that makes it quicker, we hope cheaper, for workers to get to and from work. So the cities began with this big program. You've seen the results already of it in the two cities. Incidentally, we're now rolling it out in six cities, and we are targeting an additional six cities, but that's an aside. So what the department's work consists of, it looked then at how this implementation is going, and it discovered that we were importing buses from Brazil. You have seen in the media this story about Brazilian buses a couple of years ago. We then sat down, convened a meeting with social partners, which led to the conclusion of the local procurement accord, sat down in government with Treasury and DTI, that led to an amendment of the regulations, the PPPFA, that governs procurement. We sat down with the IDC, which is the entity that we strategically manage, and spoke to it about the market opportunities with public transport. So those were the three initiatives. Result. Result is Joburg Municipality introduced a new condition in the tender last year that requires the bulk of the bus, each bus that they buy, to be made locally. The chassis will be, which is basically the frame on which a bus or a car is, will be made at Mercedes-Benz in East London. The bus itself will be assembled at Marco Polo in Joburg. In Cape Town, working in partnership with the city, they also have introduced the same regulation, and the reason why they do it is because we've now set the national standard that all buses, bus bodies, must have a specified local content. So Cape Town is now advertising the buses it requires with the same local content requirement. What will be the net result? The net result will be more than 200 buses that will be bought by these two cities will be made locally. The IDC has co-invested and supported the setting up of a factory in Cape Town, a company called BusMart, and we will then have two places where buses are essentially assembled locally instead of imported from Brazil. That means South Africans, when we get into buses in future, will be riding on locally made vehicles. We would have helped to create jobs, deepen industrialization in the country. And here's the opportunity, if we do it well, and we're not there yet, but if we do it well, is create a sufficiently competitive local industry that can supply buses to the rest of the continent and indeed to other emerging markets. So this is an example of a plan, Honorable Mabasa, that then gets taken through the implementation loop, using, among others, Honorable Shlengwa, the local procurement accord, taking vertical integration, Honorable Ntuli, between national government and two cities of Joburg and Cape Town, and engaging with the IEDC, the interface with entities, Honorable Mubu, that's how we brought this package together. Because simply asserting that we want local buses would not have cut it. You need the legal tools, the regulations had to be changed. You need the financial tools, the IEDC had to be prepared to support this. You needed to create the market, so you needed the tender specification. You needed the support of the private sector, so you need the local procurement board. That's one example. And it also answers the question that was asked by Honorable Nturi, are we making any progress with local products? I can use a second example from a similar sector, which is taxis. In 2009, we realized that as part of our transformation of public transport, minibus taxis will be a part of our integrated transport system. We were not going to replace them. They were going to be an element of it. But when we looked at the taxis, we realized, like buses, they were made abroad, were all imported. In 2009, this country did not manufacture a single taxi, did not assemble a single taxi, imported completed taxis from elsewhere in the world. To compound it, nowhere on the African continent was anyone making or assembling taxis. We were a consumer of products made on other continents. So we started to move towards changing that. So what did we do? Step one, I met with CEO of Toyota, Johan van Zyl, who also serves on the Toyota main board in Japan, and said to him that how policy direction is localization. Can Toyota be a partner? Following discussions with the Toyota board, he came back to say, yes, they can be, and he pointed out what they would require, what kind of environment we needed to get. And so working in partnership with the DTI, who is a really strong and close partner for EDD, we started to look at what adjustments are required to the Mobility Industry Development Plan, which is administered by the DTI, so you have this horizontal coordination now. Eventually we settled the issue, and Toyota expanded its factory in Etekwini, producing a significant number of new taxis from the middle of last year. Then the IEDC partnered with a company called Beijing Automotive Works, BAW, which is a Chinese, what they call OEM manufacturer. It's a manufacturer of the original equipment. And it's one of China's large car makers. And up to now, there's been some import of taxis from China. And he said to the Chinese that our policy direction is localization. So IDC and BAW entered into a joint venture to open a factory in Springs in Gauteng. And it started assembly of taxis in January this year. So now we have two producers or assemblers of taxis that will be supplying the local market. During this year, 2013, our anticipation, based on production figures of two companies, is that we would have achieved 50% localization. In other words, 50% of the new taxis bought in South Africa this year would be manufactured or assembled in South Africa. And over the next couple of years, our hope is that that percentage can grow to at least 66%. So there's an example. I think the best way to illustrate this is not to talk conceptually about coordination and planning and integration. It's to show with these examples how what we need to do is to connect the different parts of the state. Because they don't get connected to each other, the opportunity is lost. That's really how EDD does a lot of its work. And of course, it's very helpful in that context that it also is responsible for your big development finance institutions like the IDC. So I hope, Honorable Mabasa, that helps to explain that what you see here as a plan has an outcome also, because we report against the APP, because the Auditor General expects us to report on how the annual performance plan is written. That is a plan. It's called APP, Annual Performance Plan. But the outcomes are often in this kind of much more interesting and helpful outcomes that I've indicated than the processes, the meetings, the activities and so on. It's these outcomes that we value. Honorable Shlengwa, you raised the question of the youth accord. I need to say that the social partners and government are in agreement on the content of the social accord. We're planning a public launch. We've had a number of different provinces all wanting to have the honor of the public launch. But there's been some negotiation. We'll make an announcement soon of where a public launch will take place, and then we'll have a symbolic signing ceremony attached to that. Honorable Shengwa asks a very interesting question on basic education and the role of education and whether the education system is responding to the needs of the economy. I think that lies at the center of what we need to do more. If you have to think of two cross-cutting issues, one is what one can call hard infrastructure, what we call the infrastructure plan. And the other thing is what economists sometimes call soft infrastructure, the skills levels in a society and economy. Now, what does the Basic Education Accord do? It recognizes the challenges and problems in the education system. They often lie in very simple things, getting a school to function, having teachers in-class teaching, having school governing bodies that meet regularly, where parents can get the principal, the teachers to be accountable, having basic equipment, textbooks. These are the minimum that you need to get a functioning school. So the Basic Education Accord says we have challenges, but it won't help us simply to say that they are products of our history. We can change our history. So we now need to take responsibility by doing things together. It provides a framework in which businesses, companies, or business organizations, trade unions, government departments, and community groupings can adopt dysfunctional schools. And in the adoption process, work with school to improve its performance. Incidentally, members of parliament will also be able to use the accord to work on adopting a school. I visited one of the schools that was adopted by a business, a big company that is active in Cape Town. And the school is in Guguletu. I was there about 5 Sundays ago and looked at what that partnership means. So what have that company done? The first thing the company has done is it's helped to upgrade the basic resources of the school. Both at the library for the school, they've purchased computers, so there are about probably 10 computers, workstations. Secondly, they've identified challenges with the teachers' training, so they did a partnership with UCT to give those teachers additional coaching and training to upgrade their skills. Thirdly, they've recognized that it's a primary school that a lot of the children lose hope and faith in maths early on, and our economy needs more maths and science skills. So they've introduced a program called EduPeg, which is a basic numeracy and literacy program that makes teaching fun and helps children who come from families where the parents have not been at university to learn basic maths. You see, if you're middle class, if you have a university education, the likelihood is your children will succeed because you're there to help them with their schoolwork, with their homework, and so on. When you're a parent from a poor community, as the majority of South Africans are, your ability to help children with their schoolwork is very, very limited. And so teachers have to be trained in supplementing that. And so the EduPeg program does that. And they've done lots of other things like that. They now measure every month the performance of the kids, they do scoreboards and so on. So I give that as an illustration of what a partnership practically means. It means not simply complaining that the schools are not performing and we are not developing the skills that's needed in a modern economy, but working to correct that. And so that's what the Basic Education Accord does. One of the issues it raises is that you need a better transition between school and work. And that's where a second accord comes in called the National Skills Accord. The National Skills Accord deals with children who have left school, either because they completed matric or those who have not completed matric. And see how can you bring them to be productive citizens and productive workers in the economy, or entrepreneurs for that matter. And there our focus is on FED colleges, on building technical skills. You know, in South Africa, the ideal for many, many years of young people would be doctors and lawyers. In Germany, a young person with energy and ambition could aim to be an artisan, a plumber or a carpenter, and to have good earnings but also high esteem in the society for being an artisan. So we've tended to build only an academic stream around our education system where you naturally progress to matric, you naturally go to university, but not all children are geared towards university, and it's not an intelligence issue. You can be extremely intelligent, but your inclination is not academic. Your inclination is more technical. And that's where the vocational training stream becomes very important, and it's been neglected in the past, and my colleague Mr. Bladen Rimandi has been putting more resources and effort into the FET college system to try to boost their profile and to encourage more young people, instead of leaving school and going straight to work, is to get additional technical training. What we hope we can do with time, but we're not there yet, is to get an apprentice system going where young people, many young people, go and do training and work simultaneously. And that's the system that you have in Austria, in Switzerland, in Germany, in most of Scandinavia. And they produce excellent skills out of that system. So, in answering your question, I think that there is more that we need to do on the education system in strengthening the technical and vocational stream, in emphasizing across both the academic and technical stream the importance of maths and science, and that what our role as a department is to help facilitate the kind of partnerships that I've pointed to that can help to do this. The third question that Honorable Shengwa asked is also a question that Honorable Ntuli has asked, and it's around the accords. Do we implement the accords? Do we monitor the accords? Are the accords working? And the answer is yes. The accords are being implemented. We are monitoring them. We've produced comprehensive report for the February cabinet lekhotla, which took place earlier this year, in which we took each of the accords that we concluded in 2011 and we gave a report on where we succeeded, what the impact and the outcomes are. The next question on the accords that was asked was, what do we anticipate? Honorable Ntuli asked the question, can we anticipate other accords? And I think one of the other honorable members may have asked a similar question. We're not chasing a target of number of accords as much as we're trying to ensure that we get agreement on the key challenges we face. So if you ask me, I think we are likely to see either new accords or deepening of the existing accords around infrastructure. We've got an MOU on infrastructure with business and labor. We need to do more there. So that's one area that we're likely to work on. As I say, we'll be doing the symbolic launch of the youth accord and then implementing it. Honorable Ntuli asked the question around DPME. We've done work jointly with DPME to look at the employment impact of the state, because government departments don't measure the jobs impact. If you think about the department, some departments have jobs programs, like the Department of Public Works has got the EPWP. All departments buy goods and services. So we buy these files as EDD. But these files can either create jobs in South Africa or it can create jobs in Germany or elsewhere in the world. So until 2009, and I've told some members in the committee this already, the files were imported from Germany. So ministers were going to meetings talking about South African jobs with a file that said made in Germany. Through our efforts as EDD, we got a local company to agree to bring its price down to match or beat the imported price, and now these files are made locally. Now that's a small, very tiny example of how a department's procurement can promote job creation. And so that's what the work with DPME was intending to do. The jury's still out on how successful that work is in changing the consciousness of departments, but it is an important element. But we're not relying only on that work. We're also relying a lot on what is called designation, where through the triple PFA, the Minister of Trade and Industry designate certain products that legally may only be bought from local companies. So the combination of the work with DPME and this work can help to achieve that outcome. Honorable Ntuli, you ask the question, can we measure the impact of entities that report to EDD on job creation? The answer is that I have introduced a system of monitoring the IDC's jobs impact. It's a fairly rigorous system. I've received reports on CIFA's job creation, but I'm not yet sure that the methodology is tight and sufficiently scientific. And we don't have means of measuring the jobs impact of the regulatory bodies, the Competition Commission and ITAC. So what we've done now, for the new APP that starts on the 1st of April this year, not the current one that we're looking at, but the new one, we've introduced a new performance indicator that will require the department 4 times a year to produce a report evaluating the jobs impact of all the entities that report to it. So honourable members will be able in future to get the concrete answer to that question, because it became evident to us in working with the IDC that what we've introduced at ministerial level is a good thing, and we should elevate it now to an APP indicator, an annual performance plan indicator. Honourable Ntuli, the jobs in the clothing and textile industries are largely jobs that were saved, but there's also been some jobs in some of the companies that have been beneficiaries of the competitiveness programs that we co-fund. I think I've answered Honourable Ntuli with the example of the taxis and buses, some products that we're now beginning to localize. They're obviously not the only ones, but they are quite strong and interesting examples. If I turn next, Honourable Ntuli, to your question on criteria that the IDC uses for making available funding from its distressed sector fund. The first thing that I would indicate is the history of the fund. The fund arose out of the 2008-2009 global economic crisis, when companies that were fundamentally sound and well managed were suddenly hit by an external hurricane that originated from the New York Stock Exchange but swept right across the world. So we recognize to let South African companies that were well managed and were basically profitable and viable, let them sink because global markets were in turmoil was not a good idea. So we introduced this fund via the IDC. We capitalized with 6.1 billion rand. And over the period, the criteria initially was the companies qualified for funding from this fund if they met a couple of criteria. Number one, their problems needed to be related to the global economic crisis. So a loss of markets elsewhere in the world, a reluctance by banks to provide funding because of the market turmoil, those kind of reasons. Second, they need to have a viable business plan. In other words, they needed to show that their problems were short-term and temporary, and with the necessary assistance, they could be nursed back to full health. And then there were other more subsidiary conditions, but that was the essential conditions. We've tweaked the distress criteria to say that it's got to be ones that are related to the overall slowdown in the global economy, so we've made it a little bit more general. But it's still a fund that's aimed at companies that can survive. It's not a long-term subsidy. One of the best examples of this fund is what happened with Bell Equipment in KwaZulu-Natal, the province that you come from, Honorable Ntuli, Richards Bay. that make earth-moving equipment. These big yellow bulldozers and so on that you see. And the challenge that they faced was they suddenly had a loss of market share. And this is a South African-owned company competing with the big players in the world, like the Cats and so on. When I say Cats, I mean caterpillars, not the ones, little animals. And the IDC stepped in, assisted the company recovered, took on extra workers. They employed 1,000 extra workers after the IDC outage. And they now got about 3,500 workers that they employ. They're the biggest employer in Lesotho. And they export to a number of other countries. So that's an example where had the state not been there to support them, the country would have gone down. But at the same time, the state is not required to be there all the time. Having given that support, which they're repaying, the state steps back. And that's the relationship that the IDC has through their fund with companies in distress. The next question that Honorable Ntuli asked was the recruitment strategy. The DG can run through the numbers. I think it's in the presentation, that you could perhaps just refresh our memories on it. But the department has basically met the target it set itself of the number of staff it must recruit in quarter two and quarter three. The department's strategy on self-recruitment, as I indicated to a previous meeting of this committee, is a medium-term plan. It covers the MDF period. So step by step, we're increasing the recruitment. We can, of course, fill all posts overnight. But a department grows, its mandate grows, its skills need grows. And so we want to make sure that we align these two. That as the department's work goes, so does its staff. And that we get value out of the existing staff, that we don't only increase the number of staff, but we also increase the productivity and the output of staff in the department, because that's what government needs from the public sector. So I think we're doing well there, notwithstanding some of the public comments. But DG can take us through the numbers. Honorable Mubu, you asked the question of the relationship between the NDP and the NGB and how they relate. The National Development Plan is the overall vision of government. It tells us where we want to be by 2030. It identifies what we need to do across a wide range of areas, connecting the economy, the demographic trajectory of the country, urbanization, climate change, regional integration, all of those elements. So it's a coherent framework. But in that framework, you need an economic strategy. And that's what the New Growth Path is. And what the NDP has helped enormously is allowing the New Growth Path to connect to the other elements of policy, so that your health, your education, all of these are connected to each other. And the New Growth Path, of course, is a cost-cutting program. You will see in the DTI's Industrial Policy Action Plan, which has just been approved by Cabinet. The DTI says that their starting point, their framework in doing IPAP is the New Growth Path. So it's not an ED, it's not a departmental plan, it's a government economic strategy within which different departments deal with it. So the NDP is the most overarching one. It covers everything. The New Growth Path covers the economy, and then there are the sector plans within the economy, like IPAP, like the energy plan, and so on. So that's how they connect with each other. Honorable Mubu, on the broad-based black economic empowerment submissions, what are the areas that EDD is looking at? The three areas that I'm focusing on and working with my colleague, the Minister of Trade and Industry, is number one, enterprise development. The BEE must look at how we can support small business and co-ops, because therein lies the ability to bring South Africans into the economy for the first time as entrepreneurs. Second, jobs. That we can't only count equity, we also have to count the contribution companies are making to employment. And third, localization. We can't have a BEE framework in which a company favors a black-owned importer. It has to create black entrepreneurs that are industrialists, that create goods, provide services in South Africa as we build this economy. So those are the three key areas we're focusing on. Honorable Mubu, I think I can point to a couple of pages that deals with the strategic engagement with the entities. It's in quarter three and quarter two reports, and they come under two sections. They come under the engagement with the economic regulatory bodies, and they come under the engagement with the development finance institutions, so the meetings with CIFA and the meetings with the IDC are documented in the presentation, and those are the ones that represent that strategic engagement. For example, on page 7 of the third quarter report, I don't have the page number handy on quarter 2, but we can provide it in the concluding remarks. Honorable Mubu asked an interesting question: how do we coordinate the large number of activities that some of these don't fall between the cracks? I think there is scope for us to improve that part of the EDD's work. So when I stand back and I play the ministerial oversight role and I look at the work that the department is doing, I see lots of very positive areas. But I do see that we can connect some of these better, and we need to have a management system that if we've done a local government intervention 3 years ago, we follow up to see is it still on track, is it still producing the goods. So that's an area I think with the new DG, she's coming with fresh approach, she's coming with a much more focused look at outcomes, not just activities in the state, but the outcomes. And that's an area that she is working on in the management plan. This, I should indicate, what we've presented for these two quarters is not even everything EDD does. These are just the areas that we do that's directly connected to a key performance indicator. The activities that we have to do that are not anticipated in the key performance indicators, and that there isn't a proper place at the moment that we report those. So therefore, we've made some adjustments to this coming year's key performance indicators so that we can report on those too. The next, Cheverson, thank you for your questions. You asked the question on the Economic Development Institute. And I should indicate here, we've had a very interesting learning experience in the state over this couple of years. When the department was first set up, we were very keen to have a separate standalone institute because we recognized that it's hard to get academics and thinkers to work in a government department. There's a lot of bureaucracy. It's a very management-driven thing. It doesn't create the environment for the kind of dispassionate research that policy thinkers often require. From our experience, we've realized two things. The one is it's still a good idea, but you can't just create an institute by creating the legal shell. You've got to start creating that institute by generating a body of intellectual work. So we've created, subsequent to this, something called a knowledge network. What's a knowledge network? A knowledge network is almost what they would call a virtual development institute. In other words, it doesn't sit in a in one single building. It doesn't have a star organogram, but it brings together academics and thinkers across the world. Let me give an example. Professor Joseph Stiglitz is one of the ex-chief economists of the World Bank. He is a Nobel Economics Laureate. He has been an advisor to President Clinton on Clinton's Economic Advisory Council. And he clearly has a deep insight into matters economic. Will he come and work in a government department in South Africa? No. He is a resident at a prestigious American university. But he can be part of a knowledge network that we create, where we can get him to give his insights into economic issues. And so we've shifted more and more of our work into knowledge networks as part of, if you like, a virtual economic development institute. One of the best examples of it was an activity we held last year where we had people from the United Nations. You see, DG just used an acronym in her thing. She didn't want to sound that she's overselling the department, so she said UNESA. That is the United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs. So they sent their deputy head to come to South Africa and work with us on a project looking at financialization of the South African economy. What's happening? What are the trends? What are the policy challenges? What are the opportunities? How does it compare with the other BRICS countries? Now, financialization of the South African economy. Now, what we then did is we set up an activity that you can call an EDI activity, Economic Development Institute activity, without having that name as a legal entity. But we got together this group of researchers and thinkers and spent some hours at the IDC working through their experiences elsewhere in the world and our experience. They then co-funded an activity, and there's some research being done. There will be research papers. In other words, all the same products that will come out of an institute, but that's now coming out of a more virtual institute. So that's what we're doing on the Economic Development Institute. Eventually, we'll still have, we think, a bricks and mortar thing, but we're no longer putting as much effort to getting the legal shell going, because we realize that even if we get the legal shell going, we're not going to attract the high quality and caliber people that we can get through the knowledge networks. So the work that's been done that we reported on is to show that we're not ignoring that indicator, but we've put more effort now into the virtual economic development work. Kaper Gus, Jefferson, you asked the question there to illustrate.
The question, Minister, what's the role of the, what will be the role of the PC in the Institute or any other PC in Parliament, or let me say the role of Parliament, therefore?
Yes. Well, Chair, I think it would be an extremely interesting step if this portfolio committee, given its broad mandate, was to take some of the areas that we're looking at in this, call it Virtual Economic Development Institute, and you had public hearings on these issues, because you're able to invite a cross-section of people in the society to come and make their presentations. You're able to provide a forum for South Africans outside of academia. And financialization of the economy is just one example that I've given. There are many other areas like that. So I think that in holding public hearings, which we're not so equipped to do as a department, Parliament is much better able to do that. You would bring life to ideas that may otherwise not have the wide publicity that it deserves. We could make available some of the experts who can provide a short anchor document for the portfolio committee. And of course, when we set up the real EDI, meaning the legal structure, then all the oversight work, quarterly targets, all of those things, the portfolio committee will also do. But the role is not only confined when we get there. It could even begin to kick in this financial year coming up with public hearings that the Portfolio Committee could hold on the areas coming out.
Just perhaps, Minister, just to beg your indulgence, I just want to understand, you say now it's a virtual development institute, it's going to be operating that fashion. Until when? Are you going to, you said something, you're looking at perhaps having a brick and mortar institute in the near future, but currently this is what you are doing. And then how do South Africans know that there is an existence of such an institute, and how do they participate? What to do to ensure their participation? Is it only also going to source or to utilize the internal expertise in whatever that you intending to do, or is it going to focus maybe in the external expertise? If you were to share that with us.
No, very happy to share that. So I think it would use both internal and external. By internal, I mean resources in the state. By external, I mean resources in the society. But also external in the sense of international expertise. One of the things we're doing now, which we'll have to look at how we coordinate the Economic Development Institute with fresh ideas, is setting up a BRICS think tank, which will be initially coordinated from a South African government point of view by the HFRC. That think tank tries to do for BRICS what the EDI and HSRC and other institutes are trying to do for South Africa, which is to provide data, information, ideas that can assist policymakers. Question would be, when would we see us migrating towards bricks and mortar structure? I would not see it in the coming financial year. I would see it beyond the current financial year of 2013-14. But I think what 2013-14 can do is deepen the knowledge networks. So by the time you have bricks and mortar, you already have all of your knowledge systems in place. You have your people, you have your publications come out, and all you have then is a place where you house a portion, and I emphasize portion, of your people. Because in the long run, and as I indicated, we've learned that the idea has shifted and changed over the period from 2009 when we first floated it, we see a much bigger long-term role for knowledge networks where people can be wherever they are in the world but work on projects jointly with the Economic Development Department. And there's a few examples if there's time a bit later that I could elaborate on how we think we can do that. So the final question that was asked, no, there are two other questions. I'll be brief on this given the time constraints. Kipagala's Special Development Framework. Basically, in this case, the Kipagala's local municipality sent us their Special Development Plan, asked us to review it, and asked us to give feedback on the coherence of the plan and the extent to which it connected with national frameworks like the New Growth Path. Now, it's not the first municipality that's done it, and there have been provinces also have done similar things. So that's what I would call demand-led. That's where people approach us, other public entities approach the Economic Development Department. Together with that, the department also run a program in partnership with the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform to look at a special framework for some of the poorest districts in the country. And that we've reported on previously, and it's an ongoing piece of work, and maybe an interesting piece of work to look at in a joint portfolio committee of rural development and economic development. Because clearly, a large number of South Africans live in the rural areas, and we've got to look at the economic regeneration of rural areas. And infrastructure is only one component of it, but an important component. Which brings me finally to the infrastructure question, Jefferson, that you've asked. How are the expenses covered? Well, first, in the adjustment process last year, there was provision made for funding on infrastructure using savings in some of the programs of EDD. And we see infrastructure not principally as a standalone sub-program of the department. Infrastructure involves policy work, planning work, and social dialogue. So the different parts of EDD's program structure and budget structure all need to get involved in the infrastructure work. What would be helpful is, as the year proceeds, we can on one occasion separate out the infrastructure spend and show the portfolio committee where it is located in the different line items. Interestingly, and I wanted to end on this note, a real positive that I hope the committee will find as a positive tool, is EDD has attempted to work in a different way on infrastructure to the traditional approach. Traditional approach is you set up a staff structure, you put up a chief directorate or branch in a department, you have a massive budget, and then you look for opportunities to spend. We've gone the other way. We said, can we use some of our existing staff, and can we, if necessary, supplement them with some additional staff? But can we then use the resources that is already in the state? ESCOM is a multi-billion rand budget. If we are going to try to create infrastructure experts in the energy field, we are simply duplicating what is there. Our role is oversight. Our role is not to do infrastructure, but it's to integrate the information, to call ESCOM in and say, hang on, why are you underspending here? So let me give an example, if I may, just on yesterday we had a management committee meeting, and one of a number of entities that we invited was the city of Joburg. We now monitor the spending infrastructure by the big municipalities, the one where there's a significant part of the capital spending located in that entity, and they're mainly metros. And look at Joburg's trends. We saw serious underspending in the first two quarters of their financial year, which differs from our financial year, so it's the one ending December. Called in the mayor, called in the head of the city administration, called in the finance person, and went through the figures, looked at what other steps can be taken. Now, where does EDD draw its expertise from? We draw it from a cross-section of people in the public sector, some of whom are seconded on a part-time basis to the department. So we have control of the staff, but we use budgets and staff other departments and other entities. So the irony will be, we won't even spend all the money that we've been allocated on infrastructure because we're getting money, so to speak, from the budgets of ESCOM, Transnet, TCTA, Broadband Infraco, CSIR, and so on, in our infrastructure work. Obviously, it's not sustainable in the long term. In the long term, you need much more integrated internal capacity. But you'll always need to have this partnership arrangement with the public entities. So it's a new and interesting model that's evolving in the infrastructure space. I'm sorry that I've perhaps not given all the questions as much time, Cheverson, but let me stop there.
Thank you, Minister. I do think that you've managed to really respond to the questions in detail and clarify some of the issues that or areas that were not quite clear. You know, the challenge is then, you know, there are so many success indicators that you've, you know, mentioned. The only challenge that we are facing, hence you had the questions, is that how do then frame that into your strategy plan so that we are able, you know, you move away from only, you know, coming in, that's limiting yourself through reporting. This also helps us to follow up and be able then to, you know, assist you in reminding you to really deal with those issues. I think that's a challenge that you need to go as you draft the reviewed strategy for the next financial year. You need to consider perhaps. The other issue that as you're speaking about the success stories, especially around the automotive industry, I just want to check with you whether you've realized or recognized any duplication in terms of support in the drive towards localization. The IDC, for an example, in the yellow fleet industry, especially supporting financing the bill. We saw it giving support in bail. At the same time, we saw DTI doing the same through their incentive scheme. How do we then minimize this duplication, you know, in that response? I'm not sure whether the support is the same or there is any difference or differentiation in terms of that. But how do we ensure that in the move towards trying to support the said industry, we also don't end up over-supplying or over-supporting others at the expense of the emerging or the newly developed industry. I think that is another area that perhaps as you monitor and evaluate, you might need to look into. Members, we heard what the minister said. I think he sort of dealt with the rest, and looking at our time, I know the DG has to come in terms of administrative, but I thought the minister managed really to touch and respond to all the issues the way we wanted, because they were more at that level than administrative. We will give the DG at the end, perhaps if you want to add, DG, if you can really help on that. Members, can we come to the third quarter quickly? Is there any areas that you feel you really want to? There's only one question related to the admin that is directed towards the DG to that regard. There's nothing wrong in saying no, we are covered, so that we save time. Otherwise, come in if you feel you have a question.
Chair, I will not focus on, if I may, on the third quarter, but something the minister said which sparked something. If I may, I will take less than 30 seconds on that.
I hope so.
No, Chair, the minister spoke about localization, and that this came into my mind, obviously, is that you've got quite a lot of private citizens engaging in tenders. And I wanted to just get from the minister, you know, the sort of monitoring and evaluation that would go into that oversight to ensure that those tenders are complying with the policy direction of localization. Because I think, you know, a lot of money is going into tenders, but maybe the output may not necessarily have walked the path of localization.
Thank you. Bob Mogo.
Chair, thank you very much. It's also something that I picked up from what the minister was saying. As in relation to what you call, it has to do with the use of expertise from other entities, the department's entities. And my concern is, and please excuse me if I misunderstood you, I think that was related to the issue of filling up positions within your department. And the problem I have is, if you don't have your own permanent expertise within your entity, within the department, how do you control those that come from outside that give you part-time, it's like part-time attention, it's like a part-time lover who doesn't give you actual time, also the job that you need. So what I'm saying is, how do you coordinate the activities so that you don't fall short on the time that you need to do the work? That's my concern, Chair. Thanks.
Thanks, Temoko. I guess there are no questions from the other side. I do have other questions, Minister. In terms of, it's more the coordination between the department and the entities, especially on the quarterly report. What is the link between what the entities are doing and what the department is doing? And because as much as really we hear much from the entities in terms of their reports, but we need to have a feeling from the department that some sort of an assessment from your side on the work of the entities. Are you happy? You used to do that, especially with the cool and summer, now with CIFA. But the general entities that would include also your regulatory bodies. I think we need to get that clear in terms of your reporting. Secondly, we haven't had much in terms of your interaction with the provinces and SALGA through your MINMEC. I think just reporting that you had meetings, it doesn't sort of give us a feel of whether what you're trying to pursue them to do is actually done in practice, especially in relation to the implementation of the NGP. So that everybody within the country, in terms of, when I say everybody, in terms of leadership of the country from the national sphere to the local sphere, is able to relate to the NGP, and not just relate, but also put into effect the ideals and objectives of that strategy, because then that would be easier then also to understand that role in terms of the national vision that comes through the tier plan NGP. So I just want to get that feel, because I'm really not getting that feel. We've done, for instance, rounds in various provinces trying to check their relationship, the relationship between the NGP and their provincial growth and development strategies. I must say that in black and white it is there, but I don't think we have a feel of, you know, their strategies being implemented. Most of them were still in the process of drafting. Some were under consultation, others they were reviewing, they have drafted, incorporated the objectives of NGP, but the fact of the matter is coming to actual implementation. Is it taking place? We heard from you that there were workshops held on the NGP. What is the outcome of those workshops? Are they yielding any successes? Is there any change, any movement that would make you really feel that really this is what we're doing? I know NGP is more focused now on the infrastructure development, but even on the infrastructure, are there any positive results that we're hearing, or is you feel there's not much that is being done, and the evaluation at the, is it happening at the NINEC level, and what is the view of the provinces in your view in as far as the incorporation and implementation of the national policy directives? I've been long. It's a very long question, but I guess you get the gist of it, Minister. Yes. I think that's where those are the questions. I have questions related to the use of, or maybe I should just leave it, the issue around the vacancies. I know that there's an issue that came out in the media around this, and I guess the department, you know, responded on that issue. But as part of doing our work, I think the department is aware that we've been asking this question around filling of vacancies, and the department has been telling us that the scarcity of the skills, the relevant skills, and so on. I don't know whether, because I guess you're sharing the skill, economic skill, with many other in the country. And I know for a fact that the Department of Higher Education is doing its best also, together with the Treasury and so forth, to really try and produce as much as possible. Is there a time when we can have a fully-fledged department? Of course, that would be in as far as, your budget is concerned, and also the budgeted vacant post for that financial year. Would there be a time when we say this is what we sought for the year financial year, and this is 92%, at least, or 94% that you could get? Because we're waiting on estimates here, we understand that. Minister, hand over to you.
Well, thank you very much for those questions again, Chair, Honourable Members. Let me deal first with the questions that the Chair has asked around avoiding duplication. I think one of the things that we're beginning to do successfully in the administration is coordinating the different support packages between DTI and EDD. I don't think we've achieved that everywhere yet. So between provinces, municipalities and national government, there's still duplication. But I use the example, Chairperson, that you gave of Bell. And it's just one of a couple of examples we can give. We looked at the package of measures that can take a company that was commercially successful but going through a difficult time and turn that company around and put it on a sustainable path. So what did it need? It needed, among others, a short-term source of funding when bank finance was limited. So the IDC provided that. That was one source. It had to be repaid, and then the company had to stand on its own feet. But it also needed to expand, and for that we looked at incorporating it. It's a vehicle that it makes into our motor industry development plan. So you're looking now for your long-term incorporation of what we can call a niche vehicle, which is, in this case, earth-moving equipment, and bring it into your general vehicle promotion scheme, which the DTI runs. So the one deals with the short-term challenge of the global economic slowdown. The other one deals with the structural issues for the long term. The second question that was put was by the Honourable Shengwa on tender monitoring, and I think Honourable Shengwa was probably referring to the localization conditions. We now put this in as a tender condition, so it's a legal requirement. But the fact that it's a legal requirement doesn't mean that it will be done. So we have in place as our absolute backstop the Auditor General, who in the audits will now also audit tenders against this condition. But before we get to the audit, which is very late in the day, this is where the expenditure is long past, there are systems in place now for the larger contracts where we look at this more carefully. And as I gave the illustration of the buses, it's not just an anonymous issue We're now working with the city of Joburg, with Marco Polo, with Buffalo City on Mercedes-Benz with the chassis, with the city of Cape Town for Busmark. We'll head up an operation here. So by identifying local entrepreneurs and connecting them with the opportunities in the state, we hope we can bring more transparency and openness to the system. Of course, it's easier to do with us than it will be possible to do with some of the smaller components that we will designate. So we will need to improve our monitoring systems way before the auditor general level to ensure that the jobs dividend in fact is achieved. Honorable Mubu has just stepped out, so let me hold his question for a moment and go to the chair's question on the coordination between the departments and the entities. Jefferson, I agree with you that strengthening that link is necessary. You know, when we started in 2009, many of the entities had no experience of regular executive oversight because there were too many entities in one ministry. Part of separating them out was providing the executive cabinet members an opportunity for more direct oversight. So we're in a better position now than we've been since 1994 in the level of oversight. But each year we need to improve it. So if I use the IDC as an example, initially it was just at a strategic level. Now it's to the point where they do a detailed quarterly report on jobs. Because one of the things we would want to play the oversight role is jobs. Provincial distribution of lending is another area that we would hold an oversight. So now they begin to report on changes in that to ensure that there is reasonably equitable distribution of industrial funding. So what do we want to do in the new financial year? Starting from the 1st of April, we want every 3 months to do a departmental assessment of the jobs impact of all the entities that report to EDD, with a view to identify positives, and there will be no doubt many positives, but also challenges where an entity is not able to achieve the development outcome. We need to know about it, and we need to ensure that Cabinet addresses the issues, and of course Parliament, playing the oversight role, ensures that the necessary spotlight and focus is put there. We haven't had instrument up to now. It's just been the entity quarterly reports that go straight to the portfolio committee, with no assessment by the department. But there's an interesting opportunity to bring the two together now. So I hope that for the new financial year we'll be able to do even more. And I agree, Chairperson, with you that it should cover the regulatory bodies. On the interaction with provinces, let me start with infrastructure and say that what our work is doing there is positive. It's having a real impact. Yesterday, for example, we sat down with the Premier of the Eastern Cape and her senior officials, and they took us through the infrastructure budget for 2012-13. The one that ends in 2 weeks' time. And we identified, we went line by line through the four big spending items, which is education, health, road and public works, which is connected as one, and human settlements. Those are the four big ones for the Eastern Cape. And we tried to identify what are the obstacles to achieving a higher spending rate than last year. And what cooperation and support do they need from national government to improve their spend rate? So there's a practical example of the kind of work that we do. And we can give plenty of examples like that, but that's a very concrete example of it. If we succeed, and we know at the end of the financial year, if we've succeeded with the Eastern Cape, the result will be, the Premier was very confident yesterday that we, it will be a positive story as a result of our interaction. It's not the first time, we've met with him now a couple of times in this financial year, and we're working with him to try to lift the overall spending rate. Now, of course, the consequence of that will be better delivery of services to South Africans. The second example I can give is with Free State, the province chairperson that you have a historical link with. If we look at the jobs numbers in the Free State, we've seen a steady decline in certain sectors over the last number of years. We've seen that the Free State economy is not going at the same rate, and jobs is not going at the same rate as the national economy. So we've begun to put together some data and information for the province that they can look at as the beginning of developing a strategy, a turnaround strategy. Let me give an example of KwaZulu-Natal. The province brings to our attention they've got a large footwear industry, manufacturing footwear, particularly in the Midlands area. As a result of problems in government's national procurement system, public entities are not ordering as many shoes as they normally do. The result, big pressure on the companies with the potential that companies would close. So what do? We step in as a department, do an audit, check which departments have ordered, have not ordered, what are the problems. The result of our activities is that something over 90,000 additional pairs of shoes are ordered. The result is obviously support of the industry. Now, all three speak to aspects of new growth path, but they're not a document. They're about the practical implementation of aspects of the new growth path. In the one case, the first case I've given, is infrastructure for Eastern Cape, which is the first jobs driver. In the second example I've given, which is Free State, it's jobs as a whole in infrastructure, where we've analyzed what's happening in mining, because Free State is dependent essentially on gold and diamonds. The big platinum boom, the coal boom, and the iron ore boom in mining has bypassed the Free State because it doesn't have that in any usable quantity. And the third example I've given is the KZN one, the local procurement, which is one of the elements of the new growth path. So that's how we're working now. It's less looking at documents, more looking at actions and activities that directly impact on jobs. That's where the department's focusing its direction. And you'll see in the new APP for the new year, we're putting a little bit less emphasis on policy development and plans, and a lot more effort and emphasis on unblocking investment opportunities and job creation opportunities. So it's not to say policy work is unimportant, it's still important, but in the balance between them, we're shifting much more towards implementation, because the early part of an administration is policy development, but then from there you've got to shift more and more towards implementation, and honorable members will be able to see that. The workshops have been helpful in raising public awareness, in making provinces more aware of procurement, local procurement. But I think they have been fairly general, and they need to be supplemented with much more detailed technical work at provincial level. So we think it's helpful, but it's not sufficient in taking matters forward. On the question that the Honourable Mubu raised, the use of expertise, the need for own permanent expertise, and I'm not going to comment on the example that the Honourable Mubu gave, since I don't have much expertise in that area. I would say, though, that I take the point that what you need is you need a core of own departmental permanent staff around which you can build part-time, contract, secondment, delegation responsibilities. If you don't have a core, then you can't coordinate the other people that you bring onto your books on a part-time basis or on a short-term contract. And so strengthening core, the minimum permanent staff, must go hand in hand with these new forms of employment relationships that we've pioneered. And that's where I think the storyline is a positive one, that we have moved towards filling permanent vacancies, and I think we're getting that balance better than we had at the start of the financial year. So we're looking better now. I think DG will be giving the information when the financial year is closed and we do our annual report. She'll be taping that information. I think honourable members will see the upward curve on the employment side. But having said that, Honourable Mubu, that we need that core, that permanent expertise that you can rely on, we also recognize we're in an area where you have, as some of the parliamentary questions point to, a very wide mandate. One moment you need people with expertise on energy issues to be able to evaluate the impact of energy prices on the economy. At another moment, you may need to look at agricultural economics. What is the growth potential of tomatoes in export and domestic markets? At another moment, you'll need technical expertise around infrastructure. How to ensure that the information we get on our dam building program, or on sanitation, or on the expansion of ports can be intelligently captured, evaluated, and assessed in the department. Now, you can't get a jack of all trades or a chain of all trades that will have a knowledge and expertise across all these areas. You need very often to bring in people with the expertise in that area, but you may not need that permanently. We invested heavily in 2009-10 in an assessment of electricity pricing. We did that substantial piece of internal work that was fed into the cabinet process during the early period of the Eskom multi-year determination. We haven't seen it replicated subsequently because that's all work we could draw on throughout. But in 2009, when we did that energy work, we didn't need to do the work on ports. That's now becoming a more important issue as we improve the logistics, the flow of exports and so on. So I think what we need is we need that combination of core skills around which you build your permanent team, and then specialist skills that you bring in on contract for a period. When you finish utilizing it, you then bring in a different set of skills. And that's the model. And it's an unconventional model because the public sector tends to employ people for every need. Even when the need disappears, you still have the people in your books. But they don't always have the capacity to shift to a new area of expertise. So I think it's managing that. We will be sharing with the portfolio committee our experiences and securing your insights and advice. Now, that brings me then, Chair, to the question that you've raised around the scarcity of skills. Our big issue is not so much only that all departments are looking in the same skills pool base. It's also, as I said, you need specialist skills. And those specialist skills are not always available at the time when you need them. So we've got to grow our own timber. We've got to be able to develop young people that can become our future strong economists, analysts, and so on. And therefore, one of the areas that I really am getting the department and the agencies to focus a lot more on is an internship program. It won't give us the skills that we need immediately, but it's growing the pool of people with the necessary knowledge and expertise. So EDB now has got a formal mandate from me to have an internship program, and so do the agencies. The private sector, of course, any excellent economist will be able to get a significant salary in the private sector. So the only way to ensure that the public sector is able to attract people is to constantly try to grow the numbers of people by providing internships and opportunities inside government departments. And that's what we will have to do on a much wider scale going forward. In the short term, how do we deal with our gap? Let me give you the example of the COP17 and COP18 talks. Highly specialized talks on climate change. You don't need an economist just with an opinion on the green economy. You need people with very technically knowledgeable skills. We're going to be crafting international agreements here on emissions and on consequences, mitigation strategies and so on. So we look around the public agencies, we find expertise in the IDC, and we then get that expertise to be part of the government team at COP17 and later in COP18. So we then use more actively the very resources we have. We don't have to get a top-ranked green economist in EDD when we can draw on a top-level green economist in the IDC, because we won't utilize a person 12 months a year. We're going to use them for COP17, COP18, COP19, but that's a couple of weeks' work. And so that's how I think we're trying to deal with this issue. In terms of the time frames, over the next number of years, by period 2015-16, we would have achieved the full utilization of our staff numbers. And so in the APP that will be tabled, in fact, we've tabled in Parliament, honorable members will see year by year our targets going up, 91%, if I recall, 95%, then 100%. So step by step, we're increasing it. I think this past year, as I've indicated, we've employed additional full-time staff. And so the vacancies are being filled. In the period ahead, improving the management systems will be key so that we get value for the taxpayer from the people on our books, integrating the skills of the agencies and other public entities with what we have as our core staff is going to be an additional focus. So I think, Chairperson, there is progress step by step on this, and it is an area that we've highlighted in the new APP for the year ahead. I think that covers the various questions. Oh, if I may just add one last thing, Chairperson, and that is returning to the question on min-max that you asked. We had a min-max recently where we looked at special economic zones, which each province wants to have a special economic zone. Because you will recall the Minister of Finance made the announcement that there will be fiscal support aware of an appropriate incentive package for companies in these special zones. Now, our role is working with the DTI to identify the kind of criteria that would apply. The next MINMEC will look at small business development, not just CIFA, which is the agency reporting to EDD, but how do you integrate what Gauteng does in small business development with what national government does? Because that, I think while we're getting a lot more coordination horizontally between national government departments, we haven't yet begun to deal with the vertical integration as well on the small business side. And so those are just some additional examples of the engagement with provinces. I like that one because it's also a focus of the portfolio committee. Portfolio committees call CIFA in, have said give us your business plan, made a number of really important suggestions. I've taken those suggestions on board. We're developing a small business promotion program based on the call by the portfolio committee that we must, now that we've got CIFA reasonably stabilized, that we've got to communicate these products much more actively in the community, not just in urban areas, but also in small towns and rural areas. So we're now working on that program, and it will be launched with the start of the new financial year. So in fact, we've got some staff secondments that we've put in place that will come into effect on or before the new financial year so that we can roll that out afterwards. So here's an example, I think, of the work that we're doing with provinces that will also connect back to the work of the Portfolio Committee. And I want to appreciate the suggestions that came up at the previous Portfolio Committee that is helping to spur and fast-track our work on communicating some of the positive products that are now coming out of government, but it is not being marketed as actively as they need to be marketed. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Minister. Can we hear from the teacher?
Chairperson, I think on the recruitment issue, the Minister has to a large extent addressed the issue. The figures for the second and third quarter were a net appointment of seven people in the second quarter, getting the numbers to 116. In the third quarter, an increase to 123. And I think that the Minister has then indicated the process from there going forward to ensure that we're able to establish a permanent core of the department that is better able to have effective project matrix systems in place and be able to manage the variety of different forms of staffing that we have in the department. The figures of the MTF do reach, to answer your question as to what the time frames are, it is a period of the MTF to reach up to 100% of the staffing capacities. I think the other aspect, perhaps just to emphasize in terms of the challenge of finding the particular skill set, we have also embarked on the process of getting in place a headhunting capacity to be able to ensure that we are able to locate the particular skill set that we need, be that for permanent specialists where we know that that is an ongoing function of the department or on a more short-term basis. I think the essence is what the Minister was saying in his ending of it, of strengthening the management system that enable us to ensure that the staff are able to deliver, so that the mechanisms in place be people there on a permanent basis as managers or permanent basis as specialists or on a secondment basis or on contract basis, that the accountability is built into the process. And I think that part of that secondment process is part of ensuring that there is a direct accountability to us as a department. And I think that that's a fundamental element of the concern that was expressed by the Honourable Member, that people may not participate as fully. Chairperson, if we could just draw your attention also to a typographical error on slide 8 of the third quarter report. The total of the value of special financing facilitated is not 465 billion, it is 7.465 billion. My apologies for that typo. If you add up the CIFA amongst the IDC and the IDC distress fund, it comes to 7.465 billion. And in the text of the
I just want you to slow down so that the members can effect the changes as well for the signature.
Page 8 of the third quarter report.
8, yes.
The third bullet.
Third bullet.
Under the indicator value of special financing.
Is that third? It should, or third? Oh, sorry about that. I was surprised what you're referring to. Okay.
It's total,
are you following?
Total of 465 billion.
Yeah.
And that should be total of 7.465 billion.
7.465 billion.
That figure, that for 7.465 billion, is the total of the CIFA, the IDC, and the IDC Distress Fund amount on the next three bullets.
Oh, so you're adding up all the figures. Okay.
And my apologies for that.
No,
it is correct in the third quarter full report. It is the correct figure.
No, I understand now. So you just left out 7 billion. You know, somebody transferred money in the treasury, one provincial treasury, instead of writing 8,000, she wrote 8 million. you can imagine the difference. Thank you very much. Are you done, teacher? Okay. Thanks very much, Minister and DG and the department. I guess everyone else has been very quiet, listening attentively as the minister was speaking. Minister, thank you really for the responses. Just on the internship issue, I think this is one area that has been warranted the members, especially on the entity side. I know in terms of competition authorities, they source their interns from the institutions of higher learning, but the challenge is that they are mainly focusing on UP, UCT, and I think it's VETS, the other one. And the issue was, why are they not also having contracts, signing MOUs with other institutions of higher learning, other than the three that they've identified, because it becomes very unfair. And you find that some of them, like the tribunal, would say that they're targeting certain, or people who are interested are mainly people of certain origins, which I'm not going to mention, but that is really worrying us, because we want inclusivity, we want access by all, and we don't want any discrimination when it comes to that, especially bearing in mind that competition issues, you can be a lawyer, but competition legal people with competition expertise are very few, especially in the previous disadvantaged communities. So we would urge you really to look into that in terms of recruitment, because most interns end up being being made permanent in those entities. As the minister was explaining the issue of part-time vis-a-vis full-time, I realized that there should be perhaps a discrepancy in terms of planning, because I don't think there's anything wrong in saying we have the total number of vacancies or staff establishment planned for the department. Out of that, we're going to have so many that would be part-time, because we will need special skills for that, so that there is no confusion in terms of, you have filled, vacancies and you having not filled vacancies, so that we deal with that issue. Because your explanation is sufficient, but safe also to say, what would then be the specialized, expertise? Because we want to know so that if we can, as members, could also assist in encouraging such people to apply. Otherwise, Minister, thank you very much. And we are also pleased by the fact that you're following on the work of the PC and encouraged that you're also taking advices and recommendations from us. And we will continue then to make those recommendations, because we believe that we're partners in this. It cannot just be your work, it's our work, and together we can try and bring better life to all our people. With those few words, I would like to say really thank you very much for the presentations, for the responses, and all the best in the work that you're doing. We know it's not easy. We know that there are challenges in the process, but we believe that nothing cannot, there's nothing that can surpass working together and making sure that, and giving your full commitment towards the work that you're doing. And we know that you can do it. Thank you very much. And members, Let me also thank you for your presence and your participation, and for making sure that the department is being made to account on the work that they are doing. The meeting, unless the minister wants to say something, a few words after the minister, then I will call off the meeting. I know we've taken up some time from the members' lunch.
Chairperson, it's really to thank you as chairperson of this committee and the honourable members. It's not only oversight that you've demonstrated today, but also you've made it a thoughtful and engaging and enjoyable process. So thank you very much to everybody.
Thank you. Members, I guess that the program is being circulated and take it as tabled. We'll then discuss and confirm it in the next meeting. Thank you. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned.